Can't tell you how many times that we've had a lesson on Noah in Vacation Bible School. It seems like a pretty obvious place to study for VBS. However, this year is the first year I've ever seen a Vacation Bible School that all the lessons are on Noah, so this is a first. We actually just got done with ours down Jackson County. So if I'd have had any sense at all, which I don't, I would have skipped one of the other lessons and already done this one, but I didn't. Partly just because I kind of got interested in it and I didn't want to miss anything. So I've actually done the other three lessons. Now, that may be a plus and maybe a minus. Because I've already done the other lessons, you'd think there'd be less of a chance of any repetition on things you've already heard. And that may or may not be so. Who knows? The other thing was, like I so often do, I got obsessed with this when I was preparing it, and I thought I was going to have a lesson on Noah and Thanksgiving, and I got to the part on the altar, and I never got off of it. So it's going to be, well, a little different, I guess. But I wanted to begin by thinking about some things, and I really do. I hope you haven't already gotten bored with this. Honestly, I don't know how you could. Because the point at which we're beginning is something that we read, and I'm sure we believe it. But as much as is possible tonight, I'd like for us to think about what it meant, think about what it looked like, think about some of the things, maybe the details are not given to us. So we're going to begin in Genesis chapter 8 and verses 20 through 22, which is the end of the chapter. And this has been now over a year. Before I read it, I want us to think about that for a second. This has been over a year. What do you think the ark smelled like? You ever thought about that? I'm almost certain it wasn't good. They've been in the dark. I'm sure they had lamps, but I'm also pretty sure that if you're on an ark in the middle of a world covered with water, you might want to be a little bit careful about what you light and where. It has been an experience, quite frankly, unlike anything else that anybody has ever experienced, I think. It was all new to them. In fact, from this point on, everything is new to them. Well, verses 20 through 22 reads as follows. And Noah built an altar unto the Lord, and took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor. And the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite any more every living thing as I have done. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, cold and heat and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. You know, since they have come to rest on those mountains, even that part has been an unbelievable delay. You think about the timing has always fascinated me of this. And why God had them go on the thing a week ahead of time. That just, you know, if I'm going to be cooped up on an airplane, I don't want to be sitting in the seat a half hour waiting for it to take off. And the thought of having to get on something that, like the Ark, a week ahead, I'm not sure why it did. We could speculate, but even that week tacked on the beginning, then you get to the point where you see it has come to rest. So there is progress, but you're still not going to get off the thing. Then Noah goes through the thing with the raven and the dove, and okay, the evidence is now that vegetation is growing, and I think God encouraged him to do that, but it's still was the next month following before God said, okay, now's the time, now you leave. And finally, that beam of light breaks into what had formerly been darkness on the pale people who are inside, who have not seen the sun in over a year. And they stepped out into a world that we cannot even imagine. It was an utterly devastated world. You know, when Peter wrote about that in 2 Peter in chapter 2 and verse 5, and he talked about God bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, it's one of those cases where you could ask some questions about what the word world means there. Because sometimes the word world means the people in it, and sometimes it means the physical planet. You know what? You could read that one either way. He may have implied it wasn't just the people. You know, God could have just sent a plague on the earth and destroyed the people, but he actually did destroy the world where the ungodly lived. And, oh, it was devastated. I can't even imagine. I don't think they recognized anything. Even presuming that they ended up in the same place they left from, and that seems a little unlikely because if you drop anything in the ocean, what are the chances it stays right there? Not very good. And they didn't have any way to steer the thing or propel it. It just went where it went, and it seems reasonable to presume it went someplace. I know where it ended up, but here they are. And this world has bound to have lost some vegetation to start with. I think the reason that God caused the delay, incidentally, wasn't just on account of Noah and his family. It's probably on account of the animals, because they had to get to a point where they could release them and they could have a fighting chance to survive. So it wasn't just a matter of, is there enough land on the top of this mountain to live on for a little while? Well, maybe, but you know, you release predator and prey in a restricted place, and the predators are going to have a field day. I think everything had to have a kind of fighting chance to get out of that immediate area and begin to go about the business of living and reproducing. But back again to the mind of Noah. He's looking at this. What once might have been a jungle is a desert. And folks, his future looks precarious. He's got seven people who are depending on him. And after over a year in the ark, I imagine there's some fear in his heart. And so he does what I think is the very best thing he could have done. And that is, he built an altar and he made a sacrifice. The Bible says of every clean animal in the ark. I'm going to tell you, and especially in view of what we're going to see in a little while, I don't know if this question has ever occurred to you before, but I'm going to ask the question and then I'm going to give it what I think is a reasonable answer. What are clean and unclean to Noah? Because that really hadn't been defined yet and would not be defined until Moses several hundred years later. Well, Moses wrote this, you might say, and God just said, without telling him that these would later be clean and unclean to the Jew, he just said, well, get 14 or 7 pairs of this one, this one, this one, this one. I don't think that's how it's used here. Now, if you ask me what evidence I have, I don't really have any. I got the same evidence that people have who think something else. But what I think is reasonable is to say the word clean and the word unclean are used in a general sense here, as we kind of see them being used later with the animals that were identified as clean and unclean under the Mosaic Covenant. That is, clean just means stuff that you would typically eat. Now, why would you say that? Well, in part because how Jews use it even today. You know the word kosher? The word kosher really means that which is allowable to eat under Old Testament law, but they generalize it to mean okay. You've heard the word kosher used that way. It just means okay. I think that's kind of how they're using clean. So I don't think that God said to Noah, gave him for no apparent reason, has to have split hooves, chew the cud, and all that sort of thing. I think he just said, now the stuff that you would typically eat, calling that clean, that you need to gather in different numbers. But one of every one of those things, which leads us to the question. By the way, it's a long introduction, short lesson, so don't get scared when I tell you we're still in the introduction, which we are. What's an altar is the next question, because we throw that word around all the time. Most of us probably know what an altar is, but let me tell you, just in case, or let me remind you if you do. If you were to see an altar, because we don't really have a lot of experience with altars, what would we think it was? Well, we'd probably say that's a grill. That's what we have at my house. We have a grill. But a grill and an altar are pretty much the same things. Now, an altar will typically be a little bigger, but it's a structure intended to roast meat in the open. But an altar obviously has a special purpose. And this is where I got bogged down, because I thought I was just going to talk about the altar a little bit. And the more I looked and the more I thought, the more about the altar. So everything you're going to hear from this point on is about the altar and the implications. So bear with me. We're going to talk about the altar of Thanksgiving tonight. There are four observations I want to make about the altar. The first one begins with this one. I think it's important. And that is, God's altars were the result of a pattern. Now, it was a pattern on their use, and you're going to see it was even a pattern with regard to their building, their construction. Well, what was the pattern with an altar? And by the way, if you can get through the story of Noah and his obedience to God without being impressed with the notion of a pattern or a blueprint, I think you're missing something. That seems to be very important, the idea that God had a way to do something, and he said, this is what to do, this is exactly how to do it, and it's so impressive that Noah doesn't deviate from that. I would say, in as much as his own ability and the technology that he had at the time was, I keep asking people about the length of the ark. We all know it's 300 cubits, whatever a cubit is, but we know that it's 300 cubits. I imagine, given the rough-hewn lumber, that if you could measure something microscopically, you might find that it's out just a little bit. We have a word for that. We call it within specs or within tolerances. I'm pretty sure it was within tolerances. I think that he followed the blueprint, inasmuch as his own ability and the technology available at the time allowed him. He followed the blueprint. Incidentally, I think that it's also true that as we're contemplating ourselves or other people, sometimes we make the mistake of trying to use a microscope and find fault when really there isn't one. But I digress. The point is, there was a pattern. Now, first off, there was a pattern of the use of the altar. It goes all the way back to the beginning of time. And although, if you scan very carefully Genesis chapter 4 and what happened with Cain and Abel, I don't think altar is mentioned in Genesis 4. But my reply to that would be, well, he sacrificed a lamb. He had to sacrifice it someplace, didn't he? It seems to me that an altar is a logical conclusion where he sacrificed that lamb. But what's interesting about it is the concept of an altar was a pattern that goes all the way back. And the Hebrews writer, of course, states in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 4, by faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, God testifying of his gifts, and by it he being dead yet speaketh. That idea of conducting a sacrifice on the altar then goes all the way back there. What about the idea of serving and worshiping God in general with the idea especially of sacrifice? Again, you're going to see a pattern that even preceded this. Like, for instance, in Genesis 4 and verse 26, Enos, the son of Seth, the Bible says, and to Seth, unto him also there was born a son, and he called his name Enos. And in his days began men to call on the name of the Lord. To call on the name of the Lord doesn't necessarily mean prayer. It usually means public worship. But given everything else that we know about public worship and the centrality of the altar and the sacrifice in that, again, I think it's a very safe conclusion to say this was part of that pattern that you see going all the way back. But here's what else is interesting, especially when you enter the Mosaic Age, they have a specific pattern even for the construction of an altar. In Exodus chapter 20 and verse 25, one such instruction is found, and it was to forbid those who had built altars from using hewn stones. Now, this is given in the context of idolatry, so we presume that this warning to use non-cut stones was to keep anybody from making images out of those stones. So in order to avoid that, you just, whatever stone you find, that's the one you use. You're not going to manipulate it at all. Later on, it appears that God authorized the use of a particular number of stones. Now, the first record of this that I know anything about was the crossing of the Jordan. And one for each tribe. They brought 12 stones in Joshua chapter 4 and verse 3 out of the Jordan, and there made an altar. And this, why do you think that's a pattern? Because way, way later in the days of Elijah, in 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 31, what do you have? You got Elijah constructing an altar. Out of what? Out of 12 stones. What's the point? The point is, if God has a pattern, we can't deviate from it. And God has a pattern for the use of another kind of altar today and another kind of sacrifice today. And if we're going to be pleasing to God, we're going to have to follow the pattern. Number two, there was a purpose that he had in his mind. What was the purpose of this altar? As near as I can read, and given the context, what's going on here, and I guess what you could call Noah's state of mind, that there were two things that were happening. Now, when we think of altars and when we think of sacrifices, we're usually thinking about sin. But I want you to know something else. We're also thinking about thanksgiving. Oftentimes, the sacrifices that were offered were what we call a free will offering. Free will offerings are usually not prompted by sin. In fact, they are not prompted by sin and usually have gladness of heart and thanksgiving at their root. You know, there is a symbolism between the offering and our communication with God today. You find it in places like Revelation 5 and verse 8, the first of the several occasions in the book of Revelation when the prayers of the saints are seen as incense offered on the golden altar, the one that was inside the most holy place, the altar of incense. And it got me thinking about the connection between this altar and a man's appeal to God. You know, people will appeal to God who don't have much to do with him given the right circumstances, don't they? I'm sure we've all had experiences of people who got religious given the right circumstances. I remember I had a teacher in high school. He was playing his cards pretty close to the vest on this topic, but I suspected that he was an agnostic. I don't think he was an out-and-out atheist, but I think he was an agnostic. I don't remember how many times that I heard him say, I guess he was a veteran of, given his age, probably World War II, And he'd always use that old saw that you've heard. He said, I've never seen an atheist in a foxhole. Given the right circumstances, people want to make an appeal to God. Here's the problem with that. Now, Noah had plenty on his plate to worry about. I told you about that already. I mean, in addition to all the other things that we thought about as far as his finally getting off the ark, there is this complication. You're over 10,000 feet up on a mountain. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever been to places where the elevations get to that point, but that's not a little thing. Add to that, if you think, well, I think I could handle that. Well, could you if you were 600 years old? That might complicate things a little bit. So we're going to communicate with God, and presumably we're going to be asking him for our help. But there are two other things that need to happen first. Number one, the altar was about sin. I told you that. Whose sin? Well, let's start with Noah. I know the Bible says back in Genesis chapter 6 that Noah was a perfect man in his generations. Hopefully you understand that doesn't mean flawless. It means upright. It means complete. It means mature. If we continue to read, of course, we're going to read the record of one major flaw, one major mistake, one major sin that Noah committed later on. He was not perfect in the sense of being flawless. Did Noah need a sacrifice? Yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. Like all the rest of us, Noah wasn't good enough. He needed a sacrifice. And then, how about this complication for you? I suspect very strongly that he was making this sacrifice on behalf of a world that had so angered God that he did this. Romans chapter 3 and verse 10, there's none righteous, no, not one. Romans chapter 3 verse 23, for all have sinned to come short of the glory of God. Boy, 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 did they ever. I don't know exactly what they did before the flood. The Bible doesn't tell us except to say they couldn't do anything but think of wrong things. Seems like anything they could think of to do, to get into, they did, and they got into it. And I've known some awfully, awfully wicked people in my day. I don't know if I've ever said it. Met anybody that I could say accurately, the only thing he thought of all day long from the time he woke up in the morning to the time he went to bed at night was wickedness. Closest I ever came to that, I think, was a few fellows I played football with. I did know a few fellows. It didn't matter what was said. It didn't matter how little sense it made to say it. No matter what you said, it got turned into something nasty that half the time didn't even make sense. I guess that's what the whole world was like in those days. I bet a couple of you have worked with people like that, haven't you? It didn't matter what you said, it got twisted into something horrible. Well, I think Noah probably had a desire to make a sacrifice, not that it would do their eternal destiny any good, but you see, this is the patriarchal age. Therefore, Noah was a priest. I think Noah had a desire to intervene. Maybe a good place to compare would be with the patriarch Job. Remember, the Bible tells us in Job chapter 1 and verse 5, that after his sons and daughters, after the days of their feasting were completed, it said Job would go and he would offer sacrifices according to the number of his children. And he had a number of children, so that was quite a few sacrifices. But then his reasoning was, just in case one of them during their good times has sinned, cursed God in their hearts, or cursed God secretly, I guess. And so he, as the patriarch of the family, wanted to try to take care of that. But see, okay, what's the connection here? Well, we're going to need some help farther. You have brought us here safely, and I don't want to make Noah into a complainer. I don't want to put words in his mouth and make you think that Noah was ungrateful. I don't think he was ungrateful, but what I'm trying to get across is this was no picnic, what they'd been through. It was difficult. It was hard. And he's going to need some more help in the days to come. But before you ask for God's help, you're going to have to do something about the sin. That's one thing. And before you ask for God's help, maybe it would be a good idea to utilize the other function of an altar, which is a medium to say to the Lord, we are thankful for where we are. I think he did that. You know, Paul writes in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 18, in everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ concerning you. In everything give thanks. That might not be the easiest thing to do all the time. Once again, since Noah was human and since he had flaws like the rest of us, do you suppose that once in a while he wasn't as thankful for his situation as he should have been? Maybe. I mean, in a year's time, maybe. But overall, he was complete and mature, and I don't think he let that characterize him. Maybe if he had those thoughts, maybe if they had them in front of each other, they could take a minute and say, now, wait a minute. Here we are. We're alive. God's going to take care of us. It's hard now, but everybody on the outside's dead. Here we are alive, and God's taking care of us. Yes, we need to be thankful. So when they get done with this incredible experience, he makes an altar and he offers burnt offerings to the Lord. The next word is perhaps the most important word that I'm going to talk to you about, and it's the word presence. Because altars were about presence, not with a T, P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E. Well, who was present? You know, the world's been full of altars. Altars are not unique to God's people. They weren't unique to the children of Israel or anybody else in the Old Testament. There are altars all over the place. People make sacrifices. I don't think they realize exactly why all the time. I suspect that their sacrifices are a corruption of God's original orders through the patriarchs, that that's what they ought to do. I don't think that it is a coincidence that making sacrifices of animals is so common. But there's something missing in all those sacrifices. And even in biblical times, there's a phenomenon. It's empty altars and or empty churches. They're similar. What kind of empty altars are you talking about? Let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 18. In 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 29, it's in the contest on Carmel between Elijah and the 450 prophets of Baal. And you probably remember all this, that he let them go first. Now, there was an altar, and the priests of Baal were basically dancing around making fools of themselves. They got to the point they were in such a frenzy they began to cut and gash themselves the way pagans do, and they kept yelling louder and louder and trying to get their God to set that sacrifice on fire. And meanwhile, Elijah's making smart remarks to them along the way. And the writer, the author who records this, throws in his own barb. There was no one that heard. There was no voice that answered. I'm not talking about the sacrifice. I'm talking about the one to whom the sacrifice appeals. And brethren, I'm here to tell you, it was an empty altar. There was no divine presence. Not while these pagans were dancing about. And then you can go to 2 Kings chapter 16 and verse 15. And there you can read about a very wicked king by the name of Ahaz. Ahaz was the first king of Judah that the Bible records as committing the atrocity of human sacrifice with his own children. But he did something else extremely, it was unbelievably foolish. He sees an altar up at Damascus in Syria. And he is there because of his association with the conquering king. And he goes up there and he is so impressed with this stupid pagan altar. Remember, he's supposed to be the king over God's people. And he's about as low down as a snake's belly. But he sees this stupid altar up at Damascus. You know what he does? He makes a replica of it. Brings it back home and he gives the order. And this is the phrase that always catches my eye. He says, from now on, we're going to use, and here's his phrasing. He says, the great altar. And he says, the old one we use to make inquiries of God. But from now on, this great altar, that's going to be the one we use. The great altar. Great altar indeed. It was a nothing altar. It was an idol offer. It was an idol, an idolatrous pattern. It was an empty altar. I don't care how many cows were burned on it. I don't care how many sheep. It was an empty altar because God wasn't there. In Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 13, you can read Isaiah's condemnations and you may not fully understand it if you just pull out a verse until you understand what he's talking about. He's not talking about Ahaz's altar. I think he's talking about the real one. Because the real one turned out to be empty at times too because of the attitude of the people and their disobedience and their thinking that by coming and making a sacrifice once in a while, that'll undo the way that we're living. And it doesn't work that way. And so God was disgusted with their sacrifices. He says, take your vain oblations, just get them away from me. I don't even want this anywhere near me. It makes me sick. You think God was present in that situation? Now, I know God is omnipresent. I know he's everywhere. I hope you know what I mean when I say, was he present? I mean, was he present with his blessing presence the way that we believe he's with us tonight. It's an empty altar. In the same fashion, the Bible talks about empty churches. And I'm not talking about buildings. I'm talking about people. I'm talking about congregations. Does the principle of the presence of God in an altar help us to understand that better? I think it does. If you go back to Revelation, you read the threat that was given to the church at Ephesus in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 5. If you've studied that book recently, you may recall that the candlestick is identified. The candlestick is the symbol of the church. There are seven of them. There are seven churches. The candlestick is the symbol of being a legitimate church of Christ. In Revelation chapter 2 and verse 5, here's his warning. He said, remember from whence thou art fallen, and repent and do the first works. Or else I will come unto thee quickly and remove thy candlestick from out of his place, except thou repent. Now, what was he telling him? Was he going to kill everybody in the church at Ephesus? I don't think so. I think what he was saying was, you may continue to meet. You may call yourself a church. You may continue to sing songs, have an offering, hear lessons. You're not a church. You're an empty altar. Why? Because you refused me. You're an empty altar. There's no candlestick here. I don't know at what point that happens, but at some point, God's people as a congregation just cease to be God's people. They're empty altars. There's more to the presence than that. There is something extraordinary that's stated, and we take it for granted. I guess I almost hope we do take it for granted, because it means that we've read it before. And when I read it a moment ago, maybe you heard it as though it were the first time. I kind of hope that maybe you did, and if not, hear it as though it's the first time now. It's in verse 21. It's one of those anthropomorphic verses that, if you don't know that word, it means assigning to someone who isn't human, in this case God, attributes that are human. And it happens all the time in the Bible with regard to God. He's given attributes like humans so that we can understand him better. We're not to presume that he's like us in those ways. But here it says this: the Lord smelled a sweet savor. God smelling the sacrifice. This is in contrast to everything I've said the past 10 minutes or so. Do you understand that? God, I've been talking about empty altars. This is an empty altar. God is there. God is a spirit, but he's smelling that sacrifice. Well, what does the sacrifice say to him? You know, it's amazing to think about the impact that smells have on us. I mean, people that study these kinds of things will tell us what a powerful memory trigger a smell can be. And you probably have some right now as you're thinking about it. Maybe they're even subconscious. And maybe you've even forgotten a smell, but when you smell this, it either brings back good memories or sometimes not so good memories. One time when I was, I was in sixth grade, the principal, who was also the sixth grade teacher, he sent me out into the storeroom to retrieve something. I don't remember what it was, but it was February. And I went out there, and I don't suppose I would have gotten in trouble over this. It wasn't exactly what I was supposed to do, but right here was the duffel bag full of our softball equipment for the spring. And before I retrieved that, I remember opening up that duffel bag, and the smell that came out of that, I still remember to this day what a wonderful smell in February. It was the smell of oiled baseball gloves. That is a great, I love that smell even to this day. Why? Because in the middle of February it says sunshine and ball playing and joy. There are some things that just smell like joy. I bet you thought I was going to give an illustration about supper if you look at me, but no, I didn't, did I? I got plenty of those too. God smelled the sacrifice. God can make whatever smell he wants to smell. So what was it in God that triggered this reaction? It was, see, Noah, my good and faithful son Noah, look what he's doing. And this is the result of it. It was the implication of that smell that pleased the Lord. Just like it's the implication from certain smells that we encounter that makes us so happy. And I think the most important presence at that altar was something that Noah could not have dreamed. At least I don't see how he could have. The reason I mentioned what I believe to be true about clean and unclean during the day of Noah was because the whole setup, the whole idea of sacrifice in the Old Testament and the lambs, and all the rules about lambs. You remember all the rules about lambs, particularly when it came to sin sacrifices? I mean, they could offer sacrifices of lambs as a free will offering that were flawed. That's okay. But when it came to sin, you remember what it had to be. It had to be a male. It had to be perfect. And then we come to the New Testament, and we find 1 Peter chapter 1 and verses 18 through 19, that the Bible begins to tell us, doesn't begin to tell us, it tells us about what real clean and unclean was always about. It was about Jesus. For as much as you know that you were not redeemed with corruptible things such as silver and gold from the vain conversation received by tradition of your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. In verse 20, he says he was foreordained. I usually kind of leave it off at verse 19, but as I was looking at that, I thought, you know, I need to at least mention verse 20. He was foreordained. Why? Because going all the way back to Noah, all that time, even before Christ, that altar too was about Jesus. And I say that altar too because clearly in 1 Peter 1 verses 18 and 19, he's talking about the lamb sacrifices that brought us through the Mosaic covenant. Well, what about those other sacrifices? What about the ones that Enos offered? What about the ones that Abel offered? What about the ones that, although the Bible doesn't tell us about the ones that Enoch offered, I'll bet he did. And we know Job did. What about all those sacrifices? Folks, they were all about Jesus. And the reason God said what he did about clean and unclean, I'm convinced, is because of who Jesus was in being offered. He was clean. And it doesn't just mean edible. It means right. He was clean. Oh yes, he was a presence there that day. That brings us to the last one. And the word is promise. The promise was important in the altar. God actually made a series of promises. We usually only take the time to remember one, and we sort of lump them all together. That's the last one, but there are actually four promises that God made at this time. The first one is prompted by his reaction to the altar and to the sacrifice and to the smell. It reads, "The Lord smelled a sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, 'I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite anymore everything living as I have done.'" The first promise God makes is that he will not curse the ground for man's sake. What does that mean? Does that mean we can do whatever anytime that we want throughout history and that God never reacts and that those reactions never harm the earth or the other living things? No, it's not what it said, not what he meant. Notice that he explains, that he elaborates at the end of the verse when he says every living thing. So it doesn't mean that God will never again react in today even a providential way to sin. I still believe righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. I believe that still. But I believe that there are implications to the behavior of mankind that impact the physical earth. But what he's talking about is by any means, see, we're going to leave off the other promise because that's distinct. By any means, God will not wipe out the earth on account of man's sin. That's promise number one. Promise number two. You know why I'm not worried about global warming? Because I believe Genesis 8:22. That's why. Well, that's not the only reason, but that's one of them. What's he say there? By the way, do you know that many premillennialists think that the Bible teaches that there will come a day when you won't be able to tell one season from another? Ask around. You'll hear people saying that. You'll have a warm day in late November. Oh, that's in the Bible. That means the Lord's coming back soon. No, it means we have a warm day late in November, lady. We've always had them. What does he say? He says, while the earth remains. Is the earth still here? Yep. Seed time, harvest. Cold, see that? Cold and heat. I'm not worried about global warming. I'm worried about what people are doing to me who think they're fighting it like Chicken Little and the sky falling, but I'm not worried about global warming. God promised the seasons would be continual. He's going to handle that one. Promise number three. It's in Genesis chapter 9. Dominion over the animals. What is stated here brings up some interesting questions. I don't really have definitive answers for it, but some people believe that based on what is stated here, that man and animals had a somewhat different relationship before the flood. Some have even argued that not only man, but all the animals were actually vegetarians before the flood. Now, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that, studying on it, scratching my head some. In fact, I scratched it so much I lost most of my hair over this thing. But anyway, I've never really come up with a conclusion. The one thing I will say is this. I have seen a lion's teeth, and it's hard to convince me that those were designed to eat grass. So, I don't know. I really don't. Some other people say animals weren't afraid, naturally afraid of humans before that. I don't know. What I do know is this. God said to Noah, from now on, you will have dominion. Now, didn't he promise that through Adam? Yeah, but this appears to be something distinct and different from that. He says in... where is that verse? It's in chapter 9 and, verse 10. And then with every living creature that is with you, of the fowl, cattle, the beast of the earth with you, that all that go out of the ark to every beast of the earth, he says, I'll establish my covenant with you, and so on and so forth. But anyway, he says, the fear of man shall be upon the beast. And that's actually back in verse 2, what I was looking for. I read over it the first time, the fear of you and the dread of you. So that's promise number 3. Which brings us to the big one, promise number 4. Promise number 4 is beginning in verse 11. I will establish my covenant with you. What was that covenant? Covenant was, I will not destroy the earth by water. How do you know that the flood covered the whole earth? Because if it didn't, God's broken his promise innumerable times. What do you mean? If it was a powerful local flood and God said, I'll never do this again, then God's a liar. And he's not a liar. This was a worldwide flood, and no, he has not done it again. And no, he will not do this anymore as long as the earth stands. Now notice this, that he doesn't say, I'll not destroy it again. He says, I won't destroy it with water again. That's an entirely different promise. But on this one, he gives a token or a sign of the covenant. Isn't it a tragedy that the sign of God's covenant has been co-opted by perverts? Isn't that pathetic? Rainbows don't mean what they're supposed to mean. Rainbows are supposed to mean, I know that God has kept his promise. That's not what they mean in America anymore. Well, let's leave that aside for a moment and think about the concept of a covenant. Covenant's an agreement. God makes covenants with mankind. Part of that covenant includes a blessing or a threat of a curse. Well, which one are you going to receive? Well, that's the way covenants work. They have what we call conditions or terms. Today, we have covenants. Sometimes we call them contracts. A contract has conditions and terms. Guess what? If you have a contract with terms and you break the terms, is the other party obligated to keep up his end of the contract? And you're thinking, that's the dumbest question I've heard all night. Everybody knows if the other person breaks the contract, you are not liable to keep it. Everybody knows that except for some people when it comes to the Bible. Now, I want you to notice that this contract was until the end of the world, so it is as long as the earth stands. Notice that it doesn't have a condition attached. Does God say, unless you really get out of hand, then I'll bring the water? No, he doesn't say that this time. But all through the Bible, we have conditional contracts, and God's faithfulness in keeping his promise is one of the reasons that we know he's going to keep his promise when it comes to the conditional contracts that he offers up. Well, what's a conditional contract? Well, here's one. Ready for this? He that believes and is baptized shall be saved. That's a conditional contract. What do you mean conditional? What if I don't do that? Then you won't be saved. He that believes and is baptized shall be saved. How do I know that's true? Look at a rainbow. God keeps his promises. We're going to sing a song of invitation. And if you happen to not be a child of God tonight, we want you to be changed. Well, what do I do to change that? I want to be a child of God. I want to be a Christian. I want to be saved. I gave you a verse a moment ago. It's one of the simplest readings anywhere in the New Testament. It's what Jesus said immediately after he told his disciples to go and preach the gospel to everybody. It's at the very end of his ministry. In fact, it's after his death and burial and resurrection, and he's getting ready to return to the Father. And so he's giving his disciples, here's what I want you to tell the world. He that believes and is baptized, that your terms shall be saved. That's his blessing. He keeps his promise. If you're outside of Christ, will you come as we stand and sing?